Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf Bedatum. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Wilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to brand new on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Get in touch with technology with Tech Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey there, everyone, and welcome to Tech Stuff. I'm Jonathan Strickland.
And I'm Lauren Volkebaum.
And we are continuing our epic adventure into the story of HBO. This is part two. If you haven't listened to part one, I highly recommend you do that, because otherwise you're just going to be totally lost. And if
you've probably you've never heard of HBO before. No, right. But we've covered a lot of really interesting territory, and we've only been with the company for 8 years since its inception. Yeah. That is how much material we have.
We just moved up to 1980, and HBO launched in 1972. That just tells you how dense the history of this cable station has been. And, you know, the reason why we're taking so much time, you might think, oh, is that just filler? No, the reason we're taking so much time is because HBO as an entity has heavily influenced what cable television is and what entertainment delivery services are in general. If it hadn't been for HBO, our landscape would be dramatically different today. So that's why we're doing it. In fact, think about it. Without HBO, you don't have cable companies, cable system operators pushing cable, copper cable, into cities anywhere near as quickly, right? You might not have ever seen it happen, or it might have taken a decade longer, which means you would not even have the infrastructure that the internet relies on today for high-speed internet. We'd be using telephone lines still.
You might furthermore not have had people adopt as quickly the idea of using satellites to beam information, television information, out to many far-spread networks.
Exactly. So, like we said, landscape, very different without HBO. Whether you love it or hate it, it's a large part of why the world is, as far as the cable world and entertainment worlds, why things are the way they are. So,
a little tiny bit of backstory. Very tiny. HBO, owned by Time.
Yes, Time Incorporated. Not Time, the physical entity, like the actual...
Not Father Time.
Not the progression of changes throughout a
not
a
the fourth
span.
Dimension.
No.
That we know of.
Time Incorporated, the company that owned Time Magazine, or still does, Time Magazine, Fortune Magazine, Sports Illustrated, et cetera, et cetera.
Correct. So in 1980, Time launched a second pay TV channel called Cinemax, primarily as a competitor to the less expensive Showtime.
Yes. So there were a couple different ways to compete against Showtime. One was, let's try and grab as much exclusive content as we possibly can that Showtime can't have, and thus people will say, hey, we want HBO because they have these movies and Showtime doesn't. However, that's really expensive. Another approach was to create a second paid television network, Cinemax, and to run a lot of the same programming that HBO itself already had and maybe concentrate on some genres that didn't necessarily fit into HBO's corporate appearances, like their culture.
And furthermore, that happened to be a lot less expensive to purchase, like cult films and kind of obscure noir stuff.
One of my favorite cult films of all time, I first saw on Cinemax. I had heard about it, but I'd never seen it. And that film, of course, is the brilliant movie Shock Treatment, the not a sequel, not a prequel, but an equal to the Rocky Horror Picture Show. And that's how I saw it. The first time I ever experienced it, it was shown on Cinemax because it fit into that realm of the Cinemax movie where there were some of these kind of cult classic, schlocky, sort of cheap movies to license, but they still had their audience. So this approach did not come without criticism, specifically from Viacom, which was the parent company of Showtime. They said that Cinemax was being offered at below cost. In other words, HBO was suffering a loss to run Cinemax just so that they could undercut Showtime. Now, if you remember, Showtime kind of, Viacom also did this thing in the last episode we talked about where Viacom ended up buying.
They kind of aggressively undercut
HBO. They essentially muscled HBO out of entire markets because they made this exclusive agreement with the largest cable provider in the United States at that time.
So there's a little bit of a war going on.
Yeah,
here.
A little bit of a So yeah, that's kind of the technical term. But Cinemax, you know, starts doing pretty well. And also in 1980, HBO has an affiliate in every single state in the United States. Now, if you listen to our last episode, you realize that's a big deal. This is the first time that any channel has been able to do that. And it is because they're using this satellite delivery system where the various cable operators across the United States have the receiver dishes that bring in the signal, and then they can distribute it to their customers. So now there's an affiliate in every state. Remember, it started off just in Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. Then it spread through most of Pennsylvania, then to New York, and then finally started to creep out into the rest of the United States. So big moment for HBO.
All of this is allowing them to have a pretty incredible profit, considering that they only hit profitability a year or two previously.
Right.
Their profits have grown 80% from 1978 to 1980.
Yeah, which again, understandable, because now they're available in way more markets. So
right.
The company is experiencing astronomical growth at this point. Because once the cable operators decide, yes, we will carry HBO, that gives HBO the chance to target new customer bases that they had no access to before.
Oh, sure. And they're, as a result, able to offer their employees some pretty ridiculous benefits.
Yeah.
It kind of, the stories that I've read about it at the time remind me a little bit of what happened after the Facebook boom.
Right.
And just that tiny freewheeling startup culture that turned into this very large, very freewheeling startup culture.
It reminds me a lot of what Google attempts to continue to push at the Googleplex. Mm-hmm. And of course, anyone who's worked in one of the satellite offices of Google probably is very familiar with what's available at the Googleplex versus what's available in some of those satellite offices. So there was also some tension between, say, HBO and the folks over at Time. Keep in mind that at this point, they're still all working in the same building. They're working in Time Incorporated's headquarters. And so you had sort of these freewheeling young guys who are running HBO who are having parties all the time. They said that essentially the motto at HBO was work, 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 party, party, party. And so, you know, any excuse to get together and have a big dinner, and, you know, they were still getting stuff done, but they also took a lot of time and developed this camaraderie. There's still some tension actually within the company itself because a very different culture existed between Time Incorporated employees and HBO. Now, in 1981, Showtime makes a big move, which you could argue at the time was mostly posturing. They decided to go to a full 24-hour schedule.
Right, because if you remember from our last episode, again, at the time, these cable stations would sign off at a certain point every night.
Yeah, like after midnight, they'd say, all right, time to go to bed because we don't have anything else we can show you.
Mm-hmm.
So Showtime goes to 24 hours. not necessarily being able to support that with enough content so that they're not incredibly repetitive. But HBO, not to be outdone, follows suit.
Mm-hmm.
So later on in 1981, they also become 24-hour. And so you, anytime you wanted to turn on HBO, if it's 3 a.m, you could turn on HBO and something would be playing. And then they end up also hitting the big time on one of those pre-buy movies we talked about. Now, this is where HBO puts in money in the pre-production phase for a movie. And in return, they get exclusive rights to show that movie on HBO for a certain length of time.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, they hit the jackpot. Now, it's not a movie that I think a lot of people are going to be rip-roaring excited about, but it was a critically acclaimed success. It was on Golden Pond.
Yeah, it won multiple Academy Awards.
Yep. So this exclusivity was a big deal. It was a movie that people had heard about. They knew that it was award-winning, and HBO was the only place you could see it outside of the theater. Now, keep in mind, this is before the home video craze starts. Like, this is really before the VCR has taken off. So HBO exclusivity in this case was really important. Now, they started moving to these output deals, which is when a pay TV service agrees to take on all the movies made by a certain studio over a certain time span. Again, tends to be kind of a grab bag situation. You might get a few big hits. You might have some mediocre films in there that, you know, some people care about, but most people don't. And you could have some outright flops. So a little bit of a risky situation. There's also this idea of a multi-year agreement, which HBO would agree to pick up a certain number of films a studio would produce over a given period of time, but have a little bit more say in which ones.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Like, you made, we want 20 movies that you guys are going to make over the course of the next 5 years.
But we get to pick them.
Yeah. So once the five-year period starts coming up, you're like, well, now
yeah, we'll take that one.
We're stuck.
Okay.
Yeah, but we got to be choosy at the beginning. Either way, these exclusivity deals were really, really expensive. And it meant that it was tough to make a profit unless you continuously grow. Now, at this time, that wasn't a problem because cable was still entering in lots more markets, which meant you had access to brand new customers. So in the early days,
you were kind of automatically growing.
Yeah. Yeah. You didn't have to worry about boosting your customer base so much because people were still eager to join. It wasn't until a couple years later that things got a little tougher, but we'll get there. So companies were paying these big bucks for exclusive rights to movies for just a couple of years. Eventually, those exclusivity rights would expire and those movies could be carried on other pay television stations like Showtime could pick it up. So in the long run, you would have a bank of movies that was essentially identical to your competitors. So for a couple of years, you'd have exclusivity, but it wasn't a long-term,
it would wind up evening out.
Yeah.
Sure.
So yeah, one of those things that, you know, they really had to look at a little bit later because it was not the best way to continuously grow your revenue. Now, 1983, we get one of my favorite stories.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. This is a big one. So 20th Century Fox negotiated to get Star Wars onto pay TV.
Yes. So Star Wars, big movie in 1977, 1983, of course, that's when Return of the Jedi came out. So the original trilogy, you know, the only one that exists, is complete at this time. And Star Wars itself, the movie that started it all, the second big blockbuster following Jaws from 1975, is available to go onto pay TV. However, it's not an exclusive deal. This is something...
Right, they negotiate to put it on every pay TV.
Television station, essentially. So Showtime's going to get it, HBO's going to get it. Now, normally, the way these channels like to try and position the big ticket items that they get is to wait and put it out on prime time, preferably like 8 p.m.
Yeah, Friday, Saturday, Sunday night. Sunday night probably preferably to really get all of the home viewers in.
Right. So you would, you know, when the weekend would come around, 8 p.m., that's when you could be guaranteed that that was when the biggest movies were going to be showcased on these pay television stations. However, Star Wars was such a big deal, being that summer blockbuster, that both Showtime and HBO wanted to make sure they took advantage of it and did not allow the other channel to show it before they did. So HBO didn't want Showtime to show it first. Showtime didn't want HBO to show it first. According to the agreement they signed with Fox, neither could show it anytime before 6 a.m. on February 1st. So both of them scheduled the first showing of Star Wars to be 6 a.m., February 1st, even knowing that that's not an ideal time for their customers
at all. Yeah.
They just didn't want the other one to get the scoop. And HBO went a step further. So remember in that last episode where I talked about cable being a cutthroat business and nothing is really, you know, off limits? That includes bribery. That's probably a strong word. HBO didn't bribe 20th Century Fox.
Well, they paid them more money. That's very much like a bribe.
Yeah, so that they could be allowed to show Star Wars 1 minute after midnight on February 1st. So 6 hours before Showtime could.
Although they weren't allowed to announce it.
Yeah, so you had to have been watching HBO
at midnight.
One minute after midnight on February 1st to have noticed that this had happened. However, they were able to say legitimately that they were the first paid television station to carry Star Wars, and that actually carried some weight. There were people who said, wait a minute, why is HBO showing it before Showtime? I should have HBO, not Showtime, despite the fact that we're talking about a 6 hour window when most people wouldn't be watching television anyway. That part didn't matter. So very interesting, that this battle happened. It was another expensive battle, but an important one. As we all know, Star Wars, one of the most important pieces of art created in the history. There's like, the Mona Lisa, Star Wars, David. That's the order it goes in. So 1983 also was the year when another amazing piece of art premiered on HBO, an original program aimed at children.
Yeah, Jim Henson's Fraggle Rock.
Yeah, down in Fraggle Rock. So I was a huge Fraggle Rock fan.
Me
back
too.
Back in the day.
Me too.
They actually came to Dragon Con, and we covered the Dragon Con parade. We actually shot this coverage, me and Ben Bolin, and Lauren, you were there, and
yeah,
we did it like Macy's Thanksgiving Day parade style. It never saw the light of day, probably because there were long stretches where nothing was happening.
Oh, we haven't had anyone had time to
edit the whole thing.
Oh, right.
It was a really long.
It was very long, yeah. But
the Fraggles were in it.
They were in it, and there is a photo gallery that I did. I was running a still camera through the parade, and so she waved at me.
Yeah. I got choked up.
Yeah.
I got choked up watching the Fraggles. I mean, I'm not embarrassed to admit it. The Fraggles meant a lot to me. I'm getting a little teary right now, in fact. But anyway, Jim Henson, Fraggle Rock. Now, Jim Henson had already had a relationship with HBO. HBO had produced a couple of years earlier a Christmas special, Emmett Otter's Jug Band Christmas.
Oh, right.
So now Jim Henson had the freedom to create this entire children's series, which lasted 5 seasons. And it ended up being a big success. It was one of the few breakaway successes of children's programming on HBO. A lot of the other programming people liked the idea of, but no one ever bothered to watch. So Fraggle Rock was not among that. That was an incredibly popular show. In fact, so popular that HBO would end up making other versions of Fraggle Rock for other countries. And some of them would have their own version of Doc and Sprocket. That wouldn't necessarily be called Doc and Sprocket, and they would be different people. Like I think in England, it was like a lighthouse keeper who was really crabby. But anyway, it would also be dubbed into different languages. So everyone had their own version of Fraggle Rock, which was kind of cool. It wasn't just it wasn't just switching out the soundtrack. It was actually tailor made to these nations.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith. When I'm not at my day job, First Take, you can find me in my studio hosting the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, at the very least, as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and politics. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions on those nauseating Cowboy fans, the chaos in Washington, D.C., and trending topics on social media, as well as my straight shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers. And I occasionally give out love advice. Yes, it's true. If you want to know my true feelings about something, I'll give it to you straight. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James.
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storr on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And another series that premiered that year, and I remember this series too, was not necessarily the news, which was kind of a news parody sketch comedy show. It was the news thing was kind of the conceit, the bookends for these various sketches that may or may not be very loosely connected.
Right. And it was Conan O'Brien's very first television writing gig.
Yep. Also, not consistently very good, but, but one of the examples of HBO getting into original programming, which is again, they started looking at how to differentiate themselves from the Showtimes of the world. And these exclusivity deals, like we said, could be really, really expensive. So maybe making original programming would have been a better approach. Now, they learned that making good original programming is very tricky. It might not be expensive, but it's very hard to do.
And that getting people to pay attention is also sometimes tricky.
Right, yeah. Sometimes they would make an amazing show that the critics loved and nobody watched.
We will talk about several of those in our third episode. But meanwhile, in 1984, 12 years after its inception, HBO finally got their own offices.
Yeah, they moved over into a building on 42nd Avenue, and it had the nickname the Flash Cube. All right, kids, years ago, like in the 80s, cameras, which had film in them, none of this digital stuff, also had flash, you know, flashes.
A separate flash unit.
Yeah.
That you had to attach to the top.
A little cube that would flash light so you could get some light on that image you're trying to capture onto film. That's why it was called the Flash Cube, because the building looked like one. So this building that looked like something you've never seen looked exactly like it.
Just like that thing.
So now you had a building where the actual departments could all sit together. The divisions were no longer divided. They could all be in a cohesive unit. So that amazing camaraderie they had developed back at Time Incorporated, when they had this kind of startup mentality, went away.
Was completely ruined.
Yeah. Suddenly they were physically closer and yet emotionally so distant. It turned out that HBO was starting to become more of a business. Less of this kind of startup entrepreneur approach. And,
it had more of a corporate structure.
Yeah. And it also was when HBO started to notice that growing as a business was going to get very difficult. They did what was called hitting the wall. The wall in this case was saturation. You had a saturation point where cable had pretty much entered all the markets it was going to go into. So that meant that you no longer could expect to suddenly have access to 20,000 new subscribers, potential new subscribers, because someone finally built the infrastructure out to this one region. Now all the regions pretty much had cable, so there were not going to be any of these gift baskets of potential customers just arriving at HBO. They were going to have to work for it.
Mm-hmm.
And also on top of that, they had a churn rate going on, right? So churn rate is when you lose a certain number of customers over a course of a general amount of time. So theirs was about 2% per month back in 1984.
Which means that in order to just stay even, you have to grow by 2%.
Right. To just maintain the same number of customers from the beginning of the month to the end of the month. If you want to grow beyond that, then obviously you have to get more than 2% new customers to replace the 2% who left. Now, some of the people who left, they left because they were relocating and eventually maybe they come back. But some of them were just saying, oh, I don't want to have this expense anymore. So you had to convince them, hey, we're worth the money. Or you had to convince new people, hey, we're worth the money. And now there were fewer new people to get access to. So this was a very scary time at HBO. You had this young company that had been used to this incredible growth, suddenly realizing, oh, things are not going to be as easy anymore. We're not going to have this essentially blank check that we can hand out for these exclusivity deals. We're not going to have this endless line of new customers coming in through the door. What are we going to do? And in fact, one of the first things they had to do was lay off about 125 employees, which was the first time in HBO's history that people had been let go like that.
Mm-hmm. Also around the same time, the VCR became a thing.
Ooh, and that was a boy. Talk about a big bite out of the business. So keep in mind, remember, this is the time when HBO, their main purpose was to create a way for people to watch these movies that were uncut and uncensored that wouldn't be carried on broadcast television. But now with the birth of the VCR and the growth of the home video market where you could go to a rental store and rent a movie, you could get access to all sorts of movies beyond the what we'll call the playlist that HBO had access to. Remember, HBO is paying licensing fees to be able to show these movies.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't have licenses for every movie. They have to pick and choose. And sometimes they pick before they even know what the movie's going to be like, and sometimes they lose out on that.
Oh, sure. And they can only air so many things at a time. They can only pay to keep so many things on the air at a single time. And whatever they happen to have might not be what you feel like watching.
Yeah.
Once stores started carrying rentable VHS tapes, it was, I mean, for younger listeners, I mean, like, I have a hard time imagining this, and I remember VHS tapes. I remember all of that very clearly, and it still sounds crazy to me that there was a time when you couldn't just watch whatever you wanted.
Yeah. No, you would go into the store and you would hope that one copy of Young Einstein was still available, because, you know, what a breakaway hit that was.
Hey, that was an important film.
Hey, Yahoo Sirius, one of my heroes, okay? Don't take anything away from the Sirius. But, yeah, just the fact that you go into the store, you know, and hope that the movie that you want is there. There was an illusion that you had a more choice with the home video market. Now, the truth was dependent upon how many copies of a certain movie the rental store had and how big a customer base it had, because there might be some movies that, unless you just lucked out, were constantly being checked out. So it seemed like you had a choice.
Even if Blockbuster had 30 copies of whatever it was, they might all be gone.
Right. Yeah. So hypothetically, you had a much larger choice, but in practice, it may or may not have happened.
And either way, it was probably more than just Beastmaster over and over and over again.
Yeah, HBO started getting there was a joke that HBO actually stood for, hey, Beastmaster's on. That was again a comment about the repeats, which were the movies that had been shown multiple times within a certain licensing period, and returns, which were movies that were still under license, but had been pulled out of the circulation of movies shown on HBO and then reinserted later on. So, you know, HBO licensed out these movies, and those licenses were very specific. They would say, you can show this movie X number of times and during these times of day.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the way you had to program an HBO schedule was dependent upon these licenses. Because some of them were like, okay, we don't want you showing this movie before 6 p.m. Well, then they would have to plan that out, you know, before 6 p.m. midnight.
I'm sure that FCC regulations and stuff like that would prevent some content from being shown during.
Yeah. HBO specifically policed themselves and they would not allow anything that was R-rated to go on before 8 p.m. So it had to be after 8 p.m. to go on to HBO. That was largely a self-imposed rule, and it was just an easy one for them to go with, because they knew that would be something that would most likely fit their subscribers' desires.
And would at least mollify the kind of groups that would have had complaints otherwise.
Exactly. Most of them, yes. So anyway, those licenses put limiting factors on HBO. How many movies they would have access to at a given time, how frequently they could show it. But then HBO also had this model, this business model, where the idea was, we're going to get this pool of movies, we're going to make a schedule where we're going to show these movies at different times on different days so that our customers can look at the schedule and say, oh, the movie I want to see is going to be on at 6 p.m. on Wednesday. I'll make sure to watch it on Wednesday at 6 p.m. But instead, what they found out was that people were treating HBO like it was a television channel.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, once VCRs entered the picture and they could just record something.
Yeah. It didn't matter so much about when it was on, but they like to.
And also, yeah, someone would just turn on the TV and just be like, oh, what's on right now? Okay.
Yeah. Oh, it's Beastmaster again. Yeah. See, that was the problem, was that people were not treating it like the way the company had thought of the service. And
Like a movie theater, right?
Yeah, exactly. We've seen this happen in other industries, right? We've seen it where someone creates a service. Let's say Twitter, great example. Someone creates a service and they have in their mind the way the service is going to be used by the customers.
And the customers go, oh, this great thing for this entirely different purpose.
Exactly.
And just run with it.
And so if you're a good company, you move with the customers and you don't try and force them into a model that they don't want. Because otherwise your business suffers. So HBO started seeing, oh, we're going to have to think of some other way to change up our programming so that we don't have the same, you know, list of movies showing so frequently, because we're going to end up driving customers away. And we're already having to deal with this churn issue and the saturation issue.
Mm-hmm.
So all of these factors were going into HBO and the executives' minds thinking, all right, we gotta think of a new way of approaching content. Meanwhile, Michael Fuchs, who we had talked about in the last episode, who had come over from a talent agency and had joined HBO, he becomes the head of HBO. He replaced Frank Biondi, who had pretty much been forced out. He had made a really expensive licensing agreement with Columbia Pictures. There's a little movie called Ghostbusters that nearly broke the bank for HBO.
Yeah.
We're talking like millions of dollars, like $40 million just to have this one movie, because they had agreed beforehand, before knowing what this was going to be, and there was no cap on how much they could spend. So that deal pretty much meant the end for Biondi.
Yeah. Well, that was the first place that I saw Ghostbusters. So.
Wow. I saw it in the theater. Opening day. The librarian scared me.
What are we in? 1984? I was two.
Moving on, we're going to take a quick break while I get my walker and make sure I go out and get some Ensure to drink. And then when we come back, we'll talk more about HBO. Let's, though, take this moment to thank our sponsor.
Working remotely, where you are shouldn't dictate what you do. Work from the road by turning your vehicle into a reliable high-speed data Wi-Fi hotspot with AT&T in-car Wi-Fi. On the network that covers more roads than any other carrier, take your work on the road and AT&T will be there to keep you connected. Connect up to 10 devices and stream conference calls, finish up that presentation, or answer last-minute emails. Why wait? Go to att.com/in-car Wi-Fi today for free trial eligibility. Based on independent third-party data, number of devices varies by manufacturer. Always pay careful attention to the road and don't drive distracted. Wi-Fi hotspot intended for passenger use only when vehicle is in operation. Compatible device and vehicle required.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith. When I'm not at my day job, First Take, you can find me in my studio hosting the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday, at the very least, as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and politics. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions on those nauseating Cowboy fans, the chaos in Washington, D.C., and trending topics on social media, as well as my straight shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers. And I occasionally give out love advice. Yes, it's true. If you want to know my true feelings about something, I'll give it to you straight. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
I'm Hannah Storm, and my podcast, NBA DNA with Hannah Storm, digs deep into the history of professional basketball, along with my own as one of the first female sportscasters.
Now let's get you up to speed on what else happened around the NBA today.
We talked to all sorts of people I interacted with, from Dr. J to Charles Barkley, and recap iconic moments.
Yes, he's got it. Here he comes. Ray rocked the baby to sleep and slam dunk.
As well as some of the wild stories behind the scenes.
We were like, what? What are we in for? The scoreboard crashes before we even tip a game off.
Today, the NBA is a global sports and entertainment giant. Players are multimillionaires and cultural icons.
Iguodala to Curry, back to Iguodala, up for the layup. Oh, blocked by James! LeBron James!
And these stories are about how we got here, both on and off the court. And what's next? Listen to NBA DNA with Hannah Storr on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
All right, we're up to 1985. And that's when HBO decided to launch a big summer advertising campaign. Now, they saw that the wall had hit. They saw the saturation and churn issue. They saw the exclusivity issue. And they thought, how can we attract more customers so that we can continue to grow? And they decided that they would really concentrate in an advertising campaign that spanned the summer of 1985. And they would repeat this a couple of times.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And why the summer, you ask? Summer is A, when kids are out of school and parents need something to do with these suddenly free tiny humans.
Yeah, most of us have to continue to work in the summer months. And so how do you keep the tiny humans from rising up against their masters and enslaving us all? Get HBO.
Furthermore, as most of us know, summer is when many television shows are in reruns. All of the really big primary primetime sort of things are broken for the summer.
Yeah, broadcast television tends to be pretty barren over the summer. Like, you're either watching reruns or stuff you just don't care about.
Especially back in those days. Yeah. These days it's changing a little bit.
It's a little bit now where you can get interesting programming,
all year.
Especially now that you have shows that are dividing their seasons up into season
5.1
and
5.2.
Breaking Bad. Don't perpetuate the Breaking Bad problem. I mean, Breaking Bad, great show, but, you know, splitting up your seasons, bad Breaking Bad, bad. All right.
But at any rate,
HBO decided, hey, we can take this opportunity to really grab this audience that doesn't yet subscribe to HBO. So what they did was they sent ads through direct mail, and they also did telemarketing. They called people, cold calling people, to convince them to sign up. And as irritating as it was,
it
worked.
Yeah.
They sent 640 million ads to folks between 1985 and 1992.
Shoot.
640 million, twice the population of the United States.
They also did start investing more in original programming.
Yes.
And you know, sports was something that they had been doing since the beginning.
Yep. That was one of the, you remember, the two things you could watch on HBO when it premiered was a movie that was about logging and a hockey game. So sports had always been part of HBO. Also, stand-up comedy specials had been a part of HBO since the early days.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Those really great old Robin Williams or Richard Pryor specials.
Steve Martin had a good one, too. Yeah, you had a bunch of people who were the loudest voices of comedy in the 70s and 80s. George Carlin, another one.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Some amazing comedians who would get their HBO special. And even to this day, you'll hear comedians talk about, you know, feeling like they made it when they got an HBO special. Like, that was like a mark of success. You know, that's when you know you've arrived. So they continue to do that. So stand-up comedy, also big. They also ended up backing several documentary series. They ended up creating several series, including a brand called America Undercover. There are several documentaries in that series. And that helped differentiate them, again, more from the Showtimes in the world. Now, keep in mind, Showtime at this point, not really getting into original programming that much. they were still very much dependent upon the uncut, uncensored versions of the movies. HBO was trying to kind of break away from that a little bit while still having movies on the channel, but trying to differentiate themselves by adding variety that you could not get anywhere else.
Right. It's a little bit, if you remember from our cable provider and streaming media discussion, or, I mean, if you pay attention to the internet these days, a little bit of what Netflix is doing to kind of try to move itself forward in front of channels like HBO.
In fact, if HBO had not done this, we would not have a Netflix.
Absolutely.
And
not.
We certainly wouldn't have a Netflix that's making its own content. Same thing with Hulu, same thing with Amazon.
Yeah.
The reason why they're able to make their own content, why that's a viable choice, is because HBO tried it and made it work.
Yeah.
Now, not everything HBO did with the independent stuff that they did, the original programming stuff, worked. And we'll talk a lot about some of both the successes and the failures. Not everything caught on. However, they also partnered at that time with a company called Thorn EMI, which was an independent film producer and video distributor. So their main business model was to partner with other movie studios that did not have a home video distribution market. So some of the big ones did. They had it all in place, where either they had their own production company or distribution company, or they partnered with someone already. Thorn EMI would partner with lots of smaller distribution companies. So they ended up getting a lot of, well, those cheap action movies, you know, the ones that starred internet darling Chuck Norris, those were big ones.
Uh-huh.
But the following year, 1986, Canon Pictures bought out Thorn EMI's interest. So HBO and Thorn EMI had HBO and Thorn EMI had partnered together. Canon Pictures comes in, buys out Thorn EMI, but still partners with HBO, and it becomes HBO/Canon Video. And again, most of the movies, low budget action films, awesome movies, not taking anything away from them. By 1987, HBO Canon ends up being renamed HBO Video. Short time later, it changes names again to HBO Entertainment. And they had a few successes, but really it was touch and go for a while. It wouldn't be until HBO original programming really took off in the 90s when HBO Entertainment had it made.
Mm-hmm.
Because now they became the distribution for HBO originals that everybody wanted to have.
Right, but at the time it was really just scraping by.
Yeah. Moving on to 1986, that's when HBO established HBO Showcase, which was an actual production company. So they had already moved into distribution, and they had a production company over on the West Coast in Los Angeles called HBO Pictures, but now they wanted to create another production company on the East Coast. So this one was based in New York. And the idea was to make grittier, more, you know, kind of realistic or hard-hitting movies than HBO Pictures was known for. So their first picture was about a KGB agent who was involved in a big CIA operation. This was actually a true story about Yuri Nasenko. So they were going kind of this hard, gritty route. And in general, people said it felt more like HBO, whereas the stuff from HBO Pictures a little more, you know, glossy and glitzy, certainly had bigger budgets, had access to bigger names. So you saw more movie stars in HBO Pictures productions, but the HBO Showcase would be the kind of more down-to-earth stuff. So both of these would eventually merge together and become HBO Films, and Colin Callender, who had been the head of HBO Showcase, became the head of this whole department. I'm sure there were some grumblings on both sides. I'm sure the Showcase folks were thinking, you know, they get all the money and they get they get access to all that talent. Whereas the Pictures folks were probably thinking, they have this crazy reputation, which we should have, because look at what we're doing. So
everyone get together and play nice.
Yeah. Fortunately, they were separated by the rest of the United States, with one being in L.A. and the other being in New York. So I think they were insulated enough where it wasn't too much of a problem. Also in 1986, now this is another big moment in HBO history, because it established a practice that ended up becoming an industry-wide standard.
Mm-hmm.
It's another reason why we really wanted to talk about HBO at length, because so many of the things they did influenced multiple industries. In this case, they began to scramble or encode signals full-time for those satellite signals. Now, if you listen to the first episode, you learned about HBO using uplinks to send a signal up to a satellite, which use transponders leased by HBO to amplify the signal, send it back down to downlinks across the nation to cable providers.
Mm-hmm, because it's spread out over the entirety of North America. And at this point, the cost of purchasing a satellite dish for yourself had lowered to the point where common families could purchase one if they wanted.
Yeah, if they saved up. I mean, even back when it was still tens of thousands of dollars, you had a few crazy people with lots of money buying these things because the signals weren't scrambled. The signals were clear.
Yeah, so, yeah. So once you bought in, for the purchase price of that satellite dish, you could watch whatever you wanted to.
Absolutely free. And so pay TV stations didn't like this because you didn't have to subscribe to cable at all. Cable companies didn't like it because you didn't have to subscribe to cable at all. You just had this dish, which at the time was enormous. This was before they had developed the dishes that are more common these days. This is when, if you remember back in the 80s, the enormous satellite dishes that might be out in front of someone's yard or in the backyard, that's what I'm talking about, the big, like, 9-footers.
Mm-hmm.
So you're able to get these signals clear. And not only that, broadcast television hated it. And you might think, well, why did broadcast television hate it? You could get those shows for free using an antenna. Well, it's because those shows aren't really free. The reason why those shows are possible at all is because they're ad-supported, right? Advertisers buy advertising time on those shows, and that money goes to the production companies. There are more steps in here, but in general, the production companies are able to make shows because the money made through advertising. Well, if you're using a satellite to pull down the raw feed, you're getting the raw feed. You're getting what's called the backhaul feed, which is before they put any commercials into the content. So you were getting commercial-free content from all the different providers, something that broadcast and cable stations and cable providers all hated. So how do you fix this problem? Well, what HBO decided to do was to invest in this encoding and scrambling technology. They ended up going with General Instruments Video Cipher 2 to encrypt the audio and video signals.
Once they've done that, you'd have to have a decryption box on the private end in order to decrypt the signals.
Right. So cable companies had these descramblers, right? They could just descramble it. And they had an agreement with HBO. Originally, it was just HBO, but other channels would follow suit. So HBO ended up, like I said, creating this industry standard approach. So the cable providers would all have these descramblers. And as a private citizen, you could get a descrambler, but it wouldn't necessarily work. You'd have to pay HBO to have access. You could actually go out and buy chips that would decrypt things for you. But often these chips would only be good for about a month. And what would happen is that the provider on the other end would see that someone, usually it's some fake address that's been made out to a customer, has not paid their bill. And so they cut off the service. So for a month you have service and then suddenly you don't. So people kept trying to find ways to get around this, but it meant that for the most part, it was much harder to pirate a signal. Now this made satellite dish owners very, very angry. They felt entitled to the stuff they were stealing because in their minds, they had paid thousands of dollars for a satellite dish. Therefore, they should have access to all this content. Despite the fact that all the content providers were saying, yeah, see, the money you spent didn't go to help pay for the actual content. And unless we get paid for the content we make, we can't make it. So you're actually talking about a behavior that ultimately will completely destroy the business that you want to enjoy. You want this content. You want to be able to watch stuff. But if we're not getting money for it, we can't make the stuff you want to watch. But the satellite owners said, I want my free HBO.
So Jonathan has some opinions.
I don't side with the pirates on this one, to be honest. I mean, I understand the other arguments, which we'll get into when we talk about streaming. It's not that I don't feel empathy for folks who want to have access to content. It's just that if you had the choice of either spending thousands of dollars for a satellite dish and then stealing everything or just subscribing.
That is a different issue. And,
yeah.
And it's a little bit on the silly end. But meanwhile, also in 1986, Jeff Bukes became HBO's chief financial officer.
He wouldn't be finished rising the ranks because if you listen to our last episode, we kind of gave it away. 1987, HBO launches Festival. This is going to sound like it's a deja vu. All over again.
right. Remember Take Two?
Yeah, that was the idea of creating a kid-friendly network that was lower priced so people who weren't either willing to pay the full subscription price for HBO or objected to the content would have an alternative.
It also did not work.
Yeah, apparently they didn't learn anything from Take Two, because Festival, to me, sounds like it was the same thing.
Exactly the same thing. Nope. Yeah, it would wind up getting canceled entirely.
Within a year. Yeah, the problem was that they were trying to target two different populations. They wanted to target the conservative older people who didn't want all that filth on their TV. And they wanted to target families with young children who wanted to have kid-friendly programming. But the problem was all the older conservatives said, why do you have all this children programming on my station? I don't want any of this. This is not interesting to me. And all the families were saying, I got this channel so that I could watch stuff and my kids could watch stuff. But when my kids have gone to bed, the only stuff you have on is On Golden Pond 40 times in a row. I don't care about that. So neither target audience was satisfied.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the lesson here is if you want to target two very different audiences, splitting the difference hardly ever works.
Rarely.
Yeah. Yes.
The next year, though, in 1988, something with kids did work out.
Yes. The Kids in the Hall, in fact, premiered on HBO. Canadian sketch comedy troupe. Brilliant. One of my favorites.
Mm-hmm.
Seen them live.
Good stuff.
They're
great. Yeah.
Yeah. I've only seen them live once. My wife's seen them live twice. She likes to hold that over me. But yeah, no, fantastic. One of the moves where HBO original programming really started to break away. And we've got a lot more to say about HBO original programming, so much so that we've got another episode of HBO coming up. So here's the thing, guys. If you have any ideas for episodes that we should definitely take on in the future, let us know. Send us an email. Our address is techstuff@discovery.com, or drop us a line on Facebook, Twitter, or Tumblr. Our handle at all three is techstuffhsw, and we will talk to you again really soon.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
It's brand new season two. I'm Marissa Thalberg.
And I'm Stephen Wolf at Adam. And we're excited to be back having bigger, bolder, and always real conversations.
Straight from the C-suite front lines of marketing, media, and more.
We have great friends joining from people you may know, like Vilmer Valderrama and Bobby Burke.
And people you'll want to know. So grab a coffee or, hey, even an Aperol Spritz and come join us on America's number one podcast network, iHeart.
Listen to Brand New on the iHeart Radio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
What's up, everybody? This is Stephen A. Smith, host of the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast. Tune in every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday at the very least as I bring you all new episodes that feature the biggest headlines in the world of sports, pop culture, business, and I answer your phone calls and respond to your tweets. You'll hear my unfiltered opinions and straight-shooter interviews with top celebrities and game changers, all that and more. So listen to the Stephen A. Smith Show podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Tamika D. Mallory.
And it's your boy, my son, the General.
And we are your hosts of TMI. And catch us every Wednesday on the Black Effect Network, breaking down social and civil rights issues, pop culture, and politics in hopes of pushing our culture forward to make the world a better place for generations to come. Listen to TMI on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
That's right. That's right.